Hello, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Dr. Robert Farley. I am an assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. I also blog at lawyersgunsmoneyblog.com and informationdissemination.net. And with me today is...
This is Michael Cohen, senior fellow at American Security Project. I blog at Democracy Arsenal and just started a regular column at Foreign Policy for their Campaign 2012 channel.
Yeah, fantastic. Oh, I thought your piece on the 68, used to get confused right away, your piece on the 68 election was fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, what's that?
No, as I say, it gives me a chance to say some nice words about Gene McCarthy, who I think is an underrated great American.
Right. So today we are going to talk about a few things, but mostly centered around the Iranian nuclear program. We'll get to a little bit about counterinsurgency at the end if we have time. So the latest news, just to set this up, the latest news from Iran, or the relatively latest news from Iran, is about what a lot of people are calling a stepped-up covert war against Iran's ballistic missile and nuclear programs. And sort of the recent big event in this, there was a drone crash yesterday, but the recent big event was an explosion at an Iranian ballistic missile facility that some people are suggesting may not have been entirely accidental. Other people are suggesting, well, you know, accidents do happen. So that's the latest thing that's happened. But the questions of the Iranian the covert action against the Iranian program are sort of embedded in a larger set of concerns about where the Iranian nuclear program is going and what regional implications there will be about the Iranian program. So, I mean, I guess to start off with, what do you think about this covert action against Iran? I mean, do you think this is accidental? Do you think it's part of a larger campaign? Or, I mean, what? I don't think I know your thoughts, but...
I mean, my assumption on this is that this is almost certainly, you know, well, I shouldn't say almost certainly, but it feels likely being an Israeli-led operation to kill Israeli Iranian scientists and, you know, certainly disrupt their nuclear planning. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see if we can find out maybe, you know, we probably will find out years later to what extent the U.S. was actually involved in this covert activity. Right. And to what extent, I mean, I'm generally sort of a little, I suppose, supportive of this, but at the same time, I mean, there are real red lines that potentially are being violated here, particularly if the U.S. is engaged in acts of war against Iran, which the executive branch has no, you know, congressional authorization to be doing. So I imagine you may have some intelligence sharing. I would think, you know, if the U.S. is involved in these types of covert attacks, and certainly if they're involved in killing Iranian scientists, that's problematic, to say the least.
Right. Although, I mean, this is a case where, at least I would suspect that people in the intelligence committees in Congress have been informed, if not to the complete extent, then at least to some extent about the action. And it's also a situation
just as they were informed about the, you know, use of torture and wireless wiretapping and so forth. I mean, you're probably right, but at the same time, I worry a little bit about it.
Right. I mean, I guess I worry about it, but. I worry more about it in the sense that I know absolutely, and I think you know too, that even if they're informed, there's no chance Congress is going to do anything at all about covert war against Iran.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so
I agree completely.
I mean, it's more of a Congress allowing the executive to do whatever it wants than sort of more serious loggerheads between Congress and the executive on this particular question.
Agreed.
Which is, that has implications for, I mean, that does have implications for democracy, and that's not awesome. But it's sort of in line with our expectations of congressional behavior from the past 30 years.
Yeah, right,
years.
Exactly. If you've been, you know, basically, you know, alive the last 10 years and following American foreign policy, none of that will seem a surprise to you. And I will say one thing that gives me a bit of pause to what I said earlier, which is that, look, I mean, Iran is clearly engaged in a proxy war with the United States. I mean, there's no question about that. And, I mean, it's a limited proxy war. It's happening in places like Lebanon. It's happening in places like the Horn of Africa. You know, so to what extent Iran is actually engaged in a proxy war, it certainly may justify U.S. responses to it. Whether it's generating nuclear scientists, that I'm less sure about. But I think you and I would both agree that we sort of reached a point now in which our two countries are a very low level, but certainly there's a proxy war going on between the U.S. and Iran.
Sure. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely the case. And also, whether we want to call it the same conflict, but there's also clearly a proxy conflict going on between Israel and Iran.
Oh, that would definitely, no. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this leads us to a conversation that you and I had on Twitter, but also that we had in the Yale Journal of International Affairs.
We did, but we had a good one on Twitter, though. Come on, that was a marathon conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we both lost a lot of Twitter followers for that.
I think that's right.
Who wants 500 tweets all on the same thing? A few other people were involved, other blogging heads, contributors like Eli Lake, Spencer Ackerman, and a few other people.
Sure.
The disagreement came down, and sometimes it got semantic, sometimes it got marginal, but came down to a claim that I'm pushing, and a claim that I'm still happy to support, which is that an Iranian nuclear weapon just isn't going to matter very much for Middle Eastern politics.
Right.
And when I say very much, it may result in some small-scale response from Israel against Hezbollah or Hamas or something along those lines. It may result in some hand-wringing from the Gulf, from the GCC. But I very much doubt that a year after Iran tests its first nuclear weapon, we are going to be able to say in any intelligible way that this has transformed Middle Eastern politics, or even that it's had a very significant impact in Middle Eastern politics. I think that in general, we are equipped to vastly overstate the impact of nuclear weapons on politics. I think that the impact of Iranian nuclear weapons is going to be a lot like the impact of North Korean nuclear weapons, which really has not justified all of the alarmism regarding North Korean nuclear weapons to this extent. Now, what does that mean in the context of this ongoing covert war? Well, you know, I mean, even though I don't think Iranian nuclear weapons are going to matter that much, I'm still not necessarily opposed to making the acquisition of them as costly as possible, because that deters other countries from embarking on their own nuclear programs. Certainly I don't consider Iranian nuclear weapons to justify any sort of more robust action against Iran.
Yeah, and the funny
and so anyway, you disagree with elements of that. I know not all of it. But you disagree with elements.
No,
of that.
No, the funny thing about this, in a way, is that you and I actually are much more in agreement than say if one of us was debating, Elliot Abrams or Daniel Plutka today. I mean, we would be a much bigger disagreement about this. I mean, I generally agree with
you. Right. But let's step back a second here, because Daniel Plutka just said, 2 days ago, that the biggest threat that an Iranian nuclear program posed was that Iran would not use its nuclear weapons.
Yes, that's right.
Because it would allow everybody to conclude that Iran having nuclear weapons was okay.
Right.
Which,
if
Iran doesn't do anything with its nuclear weapons, is actually okay.
Right. But I think we disagree with that. I mean, for the most part. I mean, let me focus on you, on your argument, because Daniel's not here. But I think the thing is that where you and I agree, I mean, I think my general sort of approach toward U.S. foreign policy in general is that we overinflate threats. And I'm doing a piece on this right now, and I'm sort of struck by the extent to which we consistently over-dramatize, over-inflate, scare ourselves by all these supposed threats, nuclear terrorism, cyber warfare, you know. I mean, we had Mitt Romney at the last debate basically say that, you know, that there's no price too small to be paid to stop Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. That's insane. I mean, it's an insane argument. And to my mind, the threat from Iran to the U.S. is actually pretty minimal. Threat to our interests is a little bit greater. But threat to the region, I think, is actually significant. And I think, you know, one of the things I think you and I disagree on this is that I'm actually – well, maybe we agree a little bit here. I think Iran getting a bomb is not so bad in the sense of what Iran will do with the bomb. To me, the bigger threat is what Iran's neighbors will do in response to Iran getting a bomb. That's the part that scares me. So I think – and I think this is one place where we really disagree about, you know, the influence of this. And I think we sort of traded historical analogies to sort of make the point about why this mattered. And we talked about sort of the Cuban Missile Crisis as an example. And I think one big difference between, you know, Iran getting a bomb, you know, and Israel having a bomb, and two countries that hate each other having bombs, and that's how that differs from, say, India, Pakistan, or the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the Cold War, is that there's no communication between the U.S. and Iran. You know, I mean, Israel and Iran. There's no red phone. You know, there's no Iranian ambassador in Tel Aviv and Israeli ambassador in Tehran as there was, you know, in during the Cold War. And that lack of communication is what scares me the most. Because you've got especially a country like Israel that looks at themselves as a one-bomb country. One bomb, you know, hits and they're basically wiped out. And so what worries me is you have then a potential of leading to miscalculation and brinkmanship run horribly awry that leads to some kind of nuclear exchange.
Okay, well, let me tell you a story here.
Okay.
You can follow along at home. There were once these two countries, and they fought a proxy war together that turned out to be a hot war against each other, and something along 50,000 people from one country died, and something along 200,000 people from the other country died. And then they fought several other proxy conflicts that involved direct fighting against one another. They did not have diplomatic representation with each other. They did not have ambassadors. They didn't even have much of a red line. And let me tell you something else. One of these countries was crazy. It was crazy leadership. It had crazy leadership that said that insisted to even its friends that they could win a nuclear war, that they could win a nuclear war because they had so many people that they could absorb all these nuclear weapons and then still win the war. And despite the fact that you had this crazy country, and despite the fact that you had ongoing territorial disputes and a very recent land war, when these countries both were nuclear, there was no incident. And, of course, these countries were the People's Republic of China and the United States.
Right.
Right. There was just as much reason to believe that the Chinese would act crazy with their nuclear weapons. And there was just as much reason to say that there was bad blood between the United States and the Chinese. And people forget this. They forget that we fought a land war against China in 1950 and 1951.
Right.
They forget that we had several territorial disputes over U.S. and Chinese proxies in the 1950s. And then they forget that Mao made a bunch of absurd declarations about how he could win a nuclear war against the United States, even without nuclear weapons. And yet, it all kind of worked out in the end, right? China turned into a relatively responsible custodian of its nuclear weapons.
Okay, there's two big differences, I'd say, in that one. The first one is that, you know, Chairman Mao and the Chinese were kind of, you know, reminds me of that James Brown song. They were talking loud and saying nothing. I mean, the fact is the Chinese could not attack the U.S. in any dramatic way with nuclear weapons. And if they tried to, they would be wiped out. I mean, this isn't a question of like, you know, right now I believe the Chinese have something like 70 missiles that can hit the United States. And the U.S. has something like 2,000 that can hit China. So it's not really a fair fight.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now, having said that, Israel and Iran have a similar situation. Israel would almost certainly have a larger capability than Iran does. The problem is that one Iranian bomb could destroy Israel. Literally one bomb could destroy Israel.
That's not actually true, Michael. I mean, you know
really?
That's not actually true. The Israelis believe that. But a single Iranian bomb cannot actually destroy Israel.
Stop. An Iranian bomb hits Tel Aviv. That doesn't basically
An Iranian bomb that hit Tel Aviv would kill 100,000, 200,000 Israelis, something along those lines. And this is what we suspect an Iranian bomb, an early Iranian bomb, would look like. Now, this might, in some sort of long-term metaphysical sense, destroy Israel in the sense that all the other people in Israel would then move out because they would think that it's a terrible idea to live this close to Iran. But, in fact, a Hiroshima or Nagasaki-sized warhead would not destroy Israel, right? It just wouldn't.
I mean, I think maybe we disagree about what the meaning of the word destroy is. I don't think Israel survived that. And
right,
I know
Go
ahead, sorry.
When we're talking about not surviving, then what you do mean there is that, okay, then if Iran got hit, or if Israel got hit by such a weapon, they would still be able to reply, right?
Yeah.
We're not talking
yeah.
about Israel not having a second strike capability because they clearly would have a second strike capability against one or even half a dozen Iranian bombs. They would clearly be able to reply with their several hundred nuclear weapons against Iran, which is a very similar relationship
Absolutely.
To what the United States and China had.
Absolutely.
And Israel might then, over the course of the next decade, people might move out of Israel, right? But that's not the same as saying one bomb would destroy
Israel.
I wish we would have a little bit more clarity about that because there are a lot of people out there who don't understand what nuclear bombs actually do.
I
understand the destructive capacity of nuclear weapons.
I think that's a semantic difference. I kind of disagree. I mean, I think, let's just use a possibly poor example, but if a Chinese bomb missile in the 50s or 60s hit L.A., it mm-hmm. wouldn't destroy America. LA, America would move on. In fact, it might even, you know, it might even do better. And I'm kidding.
Right.
But the if a bomb hits Tel Aviv, a nuclear bomb hits Tel Aviv, I mean, I think whatever you and I may think about what the result of that is, the Israelis certainly mm-hmm. believe that is an existential threat to Israel. Okay, so I don't think even, I mean, I disagree with you about the effect of it, but I don't think it even matters. I think the matters that the Israelis would view the potential of a nuke hitting anywhere in their country to be a complete disaster and something they cannot allow to happen.
And I mean, I want to go back to something you just suggested about Mao and what the Chinese said during the 50s and 60s. And you were sort of suggesting that it was a lot of talk in a badge, right? Or words are wind and that the Chinese were just acting crazy. Let me suggest to you that both the Iranians and the Israelis have an appreciation of strategic rhetoric, and that both countries are willing to employ aggressive strategic rhetoric that they don't actually believe.
Okay, I mean, I think that makes sense, but that doesn't.
I mean,
but
everybody agrees.
Point. I mean, I agree with that. Yes, of course, they use rhetoric that they don't mean, and they say things that they're not going to follow through on. But you and I both know that we have studied enough global history in our lives to know that countries make stupid mistakes all the time when it comes to warfare, and they literally commit national suicide, some variation of national suicide in the process. And there are more examples than you. I mean, countries. We go back to World War I, you know, Serbia, Belgium, countries that got involved in conflicts. That, I mean, you could even say the UK to a lesser extent. Countries that get involved in conflicts that are where the price that they pay is so much greater than any benefit they receive from going to war in the first place. Or certainly where the smart, rational move would have been to simply have acquiesced to countries invading them. You know, so my concern here is not whether...
Right. I mean, let's just stop. I don't accept those examples, right? I mean, I actually reject your claims on those examples, that either Belgian or Serbian behavior constituted national suicide. I mean, I think it constituted long-range planning, long-range national planning.
I disagree that it constituted national suicide. But they certainly were, if you look back, if from a rational standpoint, okay, there's no question that both countries would have been better off simply acquiescing to use of force by Germany or Austria-Hungary.
No, I don't. I don't agree with that at all. In fact, in the Serbian case, I think that there was long-range planning and a long-range understanding that Austria-Hungary might well lose the war and that Serbia might benefit, as Serbia did, from a larger Allied victory. I mean, I don't think that was insane. I don't think that it was unreasonable, and I don't think it constituted national suicide to reject a set of Austrian demands that would have ended Serbian sovereignty.
Okay. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that, but okay. I mean, we don't have to have World War I here, but I don't know if I'd agree with that. I mean, I think...
Right.
Anyway, let's move on. I mean, the point being, just the larger point is that countries get involved in conflicts they shouldn't get involved with, that from a rational standpoint, that are not in their interest to do so, and they do anyway because of miscalculation, because of certainly, you know, brinkmanship. I mean, I could argue about U.S. and Vietnam as not the realm of national suicide, but certainly a horrible miscalculation that, in looking at in retrospect, makes no rational sense whatsoever. Well, very little rational sense, I should say.
It really depends a lot, and we may be overusing the term rational here.
Maybe, yeah.
But what I would suggest is that nuclear weapons have a way of concentrating the mind, right, and of clarifying costs and benefits, which is why even countries that historically have been extremely hostile to one another, and even countries that have made all sorts of aggressive claims about world conquest and so forth, have not, in fact, used nuclear weapons against each other, but have generally operated, you know, by and large, with a great deal of responsibility regarding how their nuclear weapons are used.
Yeah, no, that's obviously true. And look, what I'm floating here are low probability scenarios, and I fully recognize that.
Right.
But one of my responses a little bit is that there's first for everything. You know, and in a sense that you're arguing with you're making an argument about, look, if we accept the notion, and let's just get that out in the open, we accept the idea that countries miscalculate all the time when it comes to issues of war and peace, that there is, when you have a lack of communication between countries, as you do between Israel and Iran, when you have extent to which both countries' interests conflict in a way that could lead to conflict between them, and certainly leading to conflict right now, there is the possibility that that miscalculation and that lack of communication leads to conflict and leads to a possibly nuclear exchange. I mean, it's unlikely. You're right, obviously, but you can't just ignore that possibility, especially dealing with weapons that are so catastrophically dangerous.
I am not ignoring that possibility. I am assessing it so low that it's not worth thinking about in policy terms. We have Cheney's 1% doctrine, right? We have Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine, which people mock, but actually it is it's a framework that makes sense for thinking about foreign policy, right? That low probability events have to be taken seriously because there are a whole bunch of low probability events that are going to happen, right? I mean, they have to happen, right? You know, you start every year with the football season and there are 32 teams and each of them winning the Super Bowl is in fact a low probability event, but you know one of them's going to win it, right? But there certainly is a floor under which we no longer take low probability events seriously, right? And because of the history of nuclear weapons use, and because I don't actually share the view that Israel and Iran have deep and intractable foreign policy disagreements. I mean, they don't share a border. They have never gone to war with each other in any meaningful sense. Iran enjoys...
Well, not directly, but indirectly they have.
Iran enjoys gaining a degree of international legitimacy or regional legitimacy by supporting anti-Israel proxies.
Sure.
But really, I think that there's more long-term conflict, long-term grounds for conflict between Israel and either of its neighbors, Syria or Egypt, than there is between Iran. Because of all these things, I assess the chance of nuclear war between the Iranians and the Israelis as extremely low, well below this 1% threshold. And look, I also want to your arguments on this, I think, are a good deal more moderate than what we often see see in Republican debates, what we see from someone like Eli Lake and so forth.
Sure.
Which suggests that nuclear weapons will grant the Iranians the ability to dominate their neighbors and so forth. And I also think that that's bunk. I think that nuclear powers have regularly discovered that they cannot actually dominate their neighbors, that they quickly tend to find out that they can't dominate their neighbors, that their neighbors quickly find out that their demands can be resisted. And so in addition to thinking that nuclear war is such a low probability between these two countries that we can effectively discount it, which is not to say that there shouldn't be communication and there shouldn't be some sort of channel set up between the countries that confirm that, but still. I also think that Iranian nuclear weapons are not effectively going to grant Iran any more influence in the region than Iran already has.
Okay, let me just say two things about that. First of all, mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that, actually. I disagree a little bit, but I think that the effect on Iran's influence in the region is probably overstated. I mean, I think you're right. If you create a relatively effective containment structure, you know, if you make clear to the Iranians that any introduction of nuclear weapons in the region by them will involve a nuclear response from both the U.S. and Israel, you can certainly deter them from using nuclear weapons, or certainly deter them from being a significant regional power. But having said that, I don't actually agree that that there's no change on the region as a whole. And I've used this example in our exchange that I think, you know, I'm proceeding from an assumption that you will have conflict between Israel and Iran unless Israel comes to their senses and, you know, makes peace with the Palestinians and gives the West Bank to the Palestinians, which probably not going to happen. But if it did happen, this whole conversation is probably moot. But assuming that doesn't happen, I think you will see conflict between Israel and Iran. I think you will see regional rivalry between the two countries. And as long as you have that, at the same time that you have this complete lack of communication between both sides, this huge amount of mistrust between both sides, and I'm sure a view among some Israelis that there are certain benefits to a single strike against Iran that would stop them from being able to attack Israel. I'm sure there are elements in Israel that believe that. And I know that actually elements in Israel believe that. If you operate from that assumption, the possibility of the conflict that exists between these two countries, you know, materializing in nuclear conflict is not something you can just dismiss out of hand. And I think, you know, the example that I use is, let's say we have a reprieve of the 06 war with Israel and Lebanon. Israel goes into southern Lebanon, they decide, you know what, we've had enough, we're going to go to Beirut and we're going to wipe out Hezbollah once and for all. You know, we're going to do what we did in 82. Iran threatens, you know, the use of nuclear weapons if Israel does that. Now, chances are that conflict will be resolved. But A, you have a huge impact on Israel's own feeling of regional dominance, regional hegemony. I mean, a big part of the reason why Israel fears a nuclear Iran nuclear weapon is because it will impinge their ability to be an unquestioned regional hegemon, which they are today. And the second thing is, again, that you have this possibility of miscalculation. And there, I keep coming back to this point. I mean, you had during the Cold War, you had during the Cuban Missile Crisis, almost between two countries that were fully aware of what would have happened had nuclear conflict unfolded. I mean, it certainly may not have been actual suicide, but it would have been pretty ugly for both countries. Had there been a different president than John F. Kennedy, the potentiality of some kind of nuclear exchange, you know, would significantly have gone up. So to my mind, if you have two rational countries that were willing to even contemplate such a possibility, I certainly think the possibility that happened between Israel and Iran is not something you can dismiss so easily.
Right. Let me go back.
There's a lot there, sorry.
Disagree with one of the arguments you're making.
Okay.
You suggested that nuclear weapons, that Israel's nuclear monopoly, are what grants it regional hegemony. First, we disagree about what hegemony means, because I don't think Israel has anything like regional hegemony. I think Israel has presumptive military dominance in the Middle East, but that's a different.
Okay, you know what? I'm willing to grant you that. That's a fair description.
What gives Israel its presumptive military dominance is not its nuclear weapons. What gives Israel the presumptive military dominance is its utter conventional dominance over any possible foe or any possible coalition of foes in the region. That's not going away when Iran builds a nuclear weapon. That's going to remain.
I agree with that.
Go ahead.
I agree with that. I mean, the nuclear weapon prevents Israel from being wiped out. I mean, I use this example in our back and forth, but in 73, there's a reason that Egypt and Syria didn't cross into Israel, because if they had, Israel would have retaliated with nuclear weapons.
Right, very possibly Israel would have done that. And the Syrians and the Egyptians understood this, and they operated under these assumptions. I mean, you know, I'm not sure why you think the Iranians are more crazy than the Egyptians or the Syrians in this case. But
no, I'm not. I'm not arguing that. I'm not. I'm saying that.
Okay, all right.
Okay, go. My argument is that you're saying there's no impact of this, and of course there's an impact. I mean, if Egypt and Syria both say we can attack into Sinai, into the Golan, we can do some damage, but we can't go too far, because if we do, we're going to hit by nukes. That means that nuclear weapons has affected their strategic calculus in a very significant way. Very different way than, say, they would have thought approached it in 67 or earlier, or certainly in 48. So I think from that perspective...
I mean, nuclear weapons, I don't think, affected Egyptian strategy whatsoever. I mean, I think Egyptian strategy was completely dominated by what the Egyptians understood as the limits of their conventional military capability, right? They had a good plan for crossing Suez. They understood if they went much farther than that they would get crushed. In order to support the Syrians, they did that anyway, and they got crushed.
Right.
So I think, you know, we have to recognize that Egyptian plans were limited, but they were limited by an understanding of Israeli conventional dominance. The Syrian case is more interesting. I will concur the Syrian case is more interesting with regards to why the Syrians only focused on the Golan Heights rather than the rest of Israel. Although I think even in that case, you know, it's very hard, right? How did nuclear weapons affect sort of anywhere in there? With regards to Beirut and with regards to Lebanon, I think, just as there are already ample reasons for countries not to consider attacking Iran and overthrowing the regime, there are ample reasons why the Israelis are already deterred from doing something like going to Beirut and wiping out Hezbollah, right? The lack of Iranian nuclear weapons in 2006 did not enable the Israelis to do anything along those lines, right? What deterred the Israelis from doing that were the overwhelming costs, both in military and political terms, of marching to Beirut and attempting to exterminate Hezbollah, right? That it was in some sense undoable, right? That they couldn't do it based on whatever cost they wanted to pay. And so when you suggest that Iranian nuclear weapons are going to eliminate that option from the Israelis, I don't actually see the Israelis as having that option at all right now. I don't see them taking that seriously as a potential policy option at this time.
Well, but okay. I mean, you can argue that the Israelis wouldn't go into Beirut because they wouldn't want to pay the sort of, I guess you might say, public relations cost. They wouldn't want to pay the cost of having to occupy, you know, most of Lebanon. You know, perhaps that is true. But certainly, if they wanted to, they could. I mean, if they wanted to do that, there's lots of things that most people think are pretty bad, and they do them anyway because they have reasonable military superiority to do them. But if Iran has a bomb, it limits that ability.
But what you seem to be arguing is that an Iranian bomb prevents the Israelis from doing stuff the Israelis wouldn't want to do in the first place.
And if that's
the case, then I don't see what a big impact of the Iranian bomb is.
I'm not saying they wouldn't do things. I mean, I still think that the Israelis would, if they feel it in their interest to do so, would, you know, pound Gaza or pound southern Lebanon. The difference is it's a subtle argument, but it's that there's limits. There are red lines that become placed upon Israel that would not exist if Iran did not have a bomb. Okay, you know, Israel would not feel any lack of discomfort in going into Lebanon and if necessary going to Beirut if they wanted to. You know, if Iran does not have a bomb, and not just there. I mean, you know, look. If Israel decides to annex portions of the West Bank, if Israel decides to deport Palestinians from the West Bank, I mean, the way Israel's going, I don't want to say those possibilities don't exist. You know, any of those policies would be – there's certainly the potentiality of those policies being of Israeli policymakers having to say to themselves, can we risk getting involved in a conflict with Iran? Can we risk the possibility of some kind of, you know – nuclear brinkmanship occurring if we do these things. I mean, I think that's a real possibility. I think if you're an Israeli politician who believes, rightly or wrongly, that one Iranian bomb would be destructive to Israel, that's something that enters into your calculus that didn't enter in before. And to my mind, that's what changes things. And this is why I think, by the way, Israel, you know, first of all, the other problem is that Israel views its role in the region as essential to their security to have military dominance. I mean, I think we agree on this point.
Uh-huh.
And if they believe that, then any country that threatens that dominance is a threat to them. And that's why I think they're so – I mean, besides the fact that Ahmadinejad says really, you know, terrible things about wiping out Israel, I think besides that, I think they see this from a strategic standpoint as something that basically that curtails their regional dominance. And that's not a minor thing. And I guess I don't see how you don't factor that into Israeli foreign policy in the region. I mean, to me, it's kind of essential.
Because I don't expect the Israelis to go to Beirut even if Iran doesn't create a nuclear weapon, right?
Okay.
I don't expect the Israelis to do these things that you insist that Israel is going to feel constrained from doing because Iran has a bomb, right?
I don't know. I mean,
one thing that an Iranian bomb might prevent Israel from doing, or might make Israel think twice about, is launching a widespread conventional attack on Iran. But as we know, Israel doesn't have much interest in launching a widespread conventional attack in Iran. Right? They've had a long time to launch a large-scale conventional attack in Iran, and they've never done it because it's never paid off for them. The only reason it would ever pay off would be to eliminate the Iranian nuclear program.
Right.
It's not something that you would just go and do,
right?
It's not something that they would see in their interest.
I agree.
And so these things that you say, oh, Israel will no longer be able to do this, and Israel will no longer be able to do this. Well, Israel doesn't want to do those things, right? And so an Iranian bomb, at best, deters Israel from doing things they don't want to do in the first place. And so that's not actually a major regional effect. That's not a significant regional impact. It's not even a significant effect on Israel's foreign policy behavior.
I don't see how that's the case. I mean, if it's part of Israeli strategic doctrine to maintain its power as a regional dominant military force, which they've done, by the way, they've done repeatedly. They bombed the Syrian nuclear power plant. They bombed the Iraqi nuclear power plant. I mean, I mean, they have consistently – this is not a minor consideration for them. I mean, this and let me say something also, that as Israel becomes more of a garrison state, and as they become more isolated from the region, which I think is going to happen, the more that they – the further along we get from a resolution to Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the further potentiality of widespread violence in the region increases, okay? Not just between Israel and Palestinians, but between Israel and the entire region. If Israel was moderating their politics, Israel was moving in a direction toward cooperation with the neighbors, I would say, yeah, you know what, not a big deal. But they're not. They're moving in the opposite direction. They're moving in a much more dangerous direction.
I'm comfortable with where we are right now, but I do want to point out to listeners that we are now talking about the impact of Iranian bomb being centrally the problem being that the Israelis might be crazy.
Yeah, and no, that's exactly it.
I want to say that I actually don't even agree. I'm not really – I mean, I understand where you are. I'm not on board. I'm not on board because I don't think the Israelis are any more crazy than the Iranians, right? I think the Israelis have done things like the attack on Iraq and the attack on the box on the Euphrates in order to reduce the military capabilities of their neighbors in a sort of very obvious and very easy way. I think they haven't done the same thing to Iran because it would be a much larger job. It would be far too costly for them to do so. But I think that these are not unreasonable assessments. I don't see any crazy to it. I don't see any indication that the Israelis are growing in this sort of very, and I don't necessarily want to talk about settlements or anything like that, but on this, on these very narrow questions that the Israelis are growing more unreasonable with regards to their strategic position in the Middle East. I would also say that there was extensive fighting and extensive violence in the Middle East prior to Israel going nuclear. There was extensive fighting and extensive violence after Israel went nuclear. And so to say that there's going to be fighting and violence in the future doesn't really indicate that there's been a profound change in the region, doesn't indicate there's been a profound change to the politics of the region.
Well, but again, I mean, there is a profound change in the sense that there's now a rival in the region that can do incredible damage. I mean, we disagree about this, but that can do great destructive damage to Israel. Okay, that's the difference.
Right.
That has not existed. I mean, I guess since 67, but probably earlier than that. So that is a change. I mean, that's a change that forces Israeli policymakers to recalculate their own position in the region. Now, granted, the rational response to the Iranian bomb, if you think about it, would be for Israel to recognize that maintaining occupation of the Palestinians in the West Bank is not in their interest and actually weakens them, puts them in more danger from a potential nuclear exchange with Iran, and would be good to resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would be a very rational response. And, you know, maybe it happens. Who knows? I mean, one can dream.
Well, you know, it's rational depending on certain premises, right, and certain assumptions about Israeli foreign policy behavior and what the Israelis actually want. But anyway, go ahead. Continue.
No, I'm sure there are those who disagree with me about this, but if Israel makes peace with Palestinians, I think it certainly lessens the chances of conflict between Israel and Iran and lessens the chances of conflict between Israel and its neighbors in general. I mean, that I think would be definitely true, and it's in Iran probably true. And so if that shift is really thinking about the territories, then that in itself would be an example of how Iranian nukes had a positive effect on the region. You know, my sense of it is, like, I'm not even saying that Israel is crazy. I don't think they're crazy. I think they from their security standpoint, their views about how to maintain dominance in the region is quite rational. Okay, but those views in many ways conflict with the views of others in the region, and that's where I think you have this potential situation where sort of brinkmanship on both sides can lead to a possible nuclear exchange. And again, I mean, it's important to say, I mean, you know, you and I, it's funny that you and I argue about this because we're probably the people standing on the sidelines saying, don't bomb Iran, don't overplay what this means.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, I don't think we should just minimize the effect it's going to have. I mean, I think that, you know, we don't know the effect it's going to have if Iran gets the bomb. We don't know if the Turks and the Saudis are going to want to build a bomb. We don't know if this creates, you know, a situation in which U.S., you know, extends a nuclear umbrella to the Gulf states. We just don't know. And that's the part that I think worries me about it. And I think, you know, maybe I'm wrong in this whole debate. I mean, it's happened before. I'm wrong all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I would rather be this.
You're wrong all the time. Admit it. He's wrong all the time, and he might be wrong about this.
I mean, I'm wrong a lot of the time, and I may be, this might be another example of my wrongness. But I feel like considering the existential nature of nuclear weaponry and the way that Israel perceives an existential threat, I just think you have to think in sort of the most fearful terms about what could happen if Iran gets a bomb.
See, I mean, here's another reason that and here's another reason I am uncompelled by the logic that Israel in particular cannot exist under an existential threat. Israel, like every other country in the world, understood that it was part of an international political system that posed, or at least people thought, but that could pose the potential for nuclear war, right? I mean, people took the idea that nuclear war might happen between the Soviet Union and the United States, maybe too seriously, maybe not too seriously, whatever. But at least to the extent that Iranian nukes pose an existential threat over Israel, then the possibility of a U.S.-Soviet exchange certainly posed an existential threat over Israel, and probably even more so because many of the most plausible scenarios, none of which were particularly plausible, but the most plausible scenarios for a nuclear exchange involve conflict in the Middle East centered on Israel. And so the idea that Israelis are particularly uncomfortable and particularly incapable of dealing with the understanding of an existential threat hanging over their heads, I find absurd, right? I mean,
I'm not saying they're not prepared to deal with okay. they dealt with the existential threat for the first 20 years of their existence. I mean, it's not unheard of for them to deal with an existential threat. And I think, for what it's worth, I think there are plenty of Israelis, wrongly, I would argue, who still believe that they are in existential danger. I mean, it's absurd in my view. But if you talk to Israelis, they believe this. They believe that if, you know, I mean, I talked to an Israeli MP who said to me, or MK, sorry, that said to me that if Hamas takes over in the West Bank, you know, this is an existential threat to Israel. I mean, people believe this. I mean, it's not rational, but they believe it. And so I think, and that's not, and that's
okay.
different than it was like 30 or 40 years ago.
Michael, you're making my case for me here, right? If Israelis right now believe that they're under an existential threat, then what difference does it make whether the Iranians
because
have a nuclear weapon or not?
Would,
right? If they already are behaving under the belief that they are under an existential
be
threat,
right.
then it's
because
unclear
they,
to me.
Because they would be right. I mean, Hamas.
Well, who cares? But you were talking about perceptions here, right? I mean, you've given up on this discussion of what's right and what's wrong, right? We've been arguing about how Israel perceives the world for this entire podcast,
a lot of it,
right?
Yeah.
And that's our key variable: how Israel perceives the world. And we actually disagree, I think, about how Israel actually perceives the world, what they say, and reality, and so forth. But if they already believe that, and if they're already operating under the assumption that they're under a constant existential threat. And again, it's hard for me to see how an Iranian nuclear weapon is going to be transformative for Israel.
Because there's existential threats, and then there's really existential threats. And an Iranian bomb really is an existential threat. I mean, it's not the same thing as Hamas taking over the West Bank. I mean, my point is that the Israelis have gone to great lengths to prevent a Palestinian state in the West Bank, in part because they believe it's some kind of a threat to Israel. I think this is crazy. I mean, if we agree they think that's a crazy threat, and we do, imagine the reaction to Iran getting a bomb. That's my point. This isn't like a rational argument about – this isn't like they're – this is – Israelis are put to this in a rational way. I mean and they're allowed to be irrational.
But we know from Goldberg, we know from a lot of sources that the Israelis don't actually think that the Iranians are going to use the nuclear weapon against them, right? I mean, we know that the Netanyahu government does not believe that a nuclear exchange is likely to result from Iran getting a nuclear weapon, right? He told Jeff Goldberg that, right? If he wanted to say something alarming about this, he could have told Jeff Goldberg, and Goldberg would have repeated it, right? But no, they said, we don't think that the main threat, we don't think that the main threat is there will be a nuclear exchange.
That's my argument. I'm not saying it. I've never said that the threat that Iran gets a bomb and they drop in Tel Aviv. I don't believe that. I don't think Israelis believe that. I don't think anyone believes that. But again, the argument is more that having that capability in their arsenal creates the opportunity and the possibility of two countries that don't like each other, that don't trust each other, that tend to think the other one's crazy, or at least one side the other one's crazy, and who have a potentiality for miscalculation could lead to war. That's more my argument.
From talking to Israelis, this is the sense that I get of their impression of Iran, of a lot of Israelis. And, you know, Israelis have a lot of different attitudes. But it's also kind of accords with mine. Very few Israelis actually think that the Iranians give a damn about the Palestinians.
Sure.
Very few Israelis actually think that the Iranians give much of a damn about Hezbollah, right? I mean, they care more about Hezbollah because there are certain long-term ties, right? And so it's difficult for me to believe, even if we start talking about you know, there are crisis dynamics, there are escalation dynamics, and so forth. Right? These exist. We shouldn't ignore them or anything like that. It's difficult for me to believe that, given that the Israelis, by and large, don't think the Iranians give a damn about the Palestinians, and given that they're probably right about that, right? That Iranian rhetoric about Palestine is almost certainly political rather than revealing of true Iranian political geostrategic preferences, right? That it's rhetoric for the Iranian population and for extremists in other part of the world. I don't see that the Israelis are going to take very seriously the notion that the Iranians are going to risk national suicide over the Palestinians. And so, again, I don't see Israel changing its behavior with regards to the Palestinians because of Iran.
No, I mean, you're probably right. I mean, that part I probably agree with. Unfortunately, I think you're right. I don't think the Israelis will change the behavior of the Palestinians. But the current situation cannot continue the way it is. And we are increasingly, in my view, moving toward a situation in which the possibility of a third intifada, the more destructive than the first intifada, it increases in likelihood. Because you have this, you have a situation in which the Israelis have shown no inclination whatsoever to make a land for peace deal with the Palestinians, and something is going to give at some point. My fear, and it may be an irrational fear, but my fear is that if that happens and Iran has a bomb, the opportunity for conflict exists, and that's where I think we should be concerned about it. But look, again, I'll step back and maybe we can move on a little bit from this. But I think you and I kind of agree about the larger threat for the Iranian bomb. I mean, I think it's a slim possibility. I think that the fear mongering that goes on the right about this is completely out of place to how big of a threat that really is. But it's not something that we can just ignore. And I think in that sense, maybe we can broaden this a little bit about the U.S. response to this. I mean, I think what we're doing to stop Iran from having a bomb right now. I mean, and this is the weird part about our conversation. I think you and I probably agree that everything Israel is the U.S. is doing right now, stop Iran from, is the right thing to do. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in broad terms, yes. I mean, I would say definitely in terms of the sanctions trade. I mean, here's the thing. Here's my attitude about nuclear weapons more generally, and nuclear proliferation more generally. Nuclear proliferation is bad. It's bad for countries to devote tremendous amounts of their resources to nuclear weapons. It's bad in terms of nuclear accidents and nuclear accident theory, and especially new nuclear powers like Iran may or may not someday be, are more prone to accidents, right? And figuring out the exact structure of command and control and so forth. It's bad in terms of what we might see in regime disintegration, right? It creates more issues during regime disintegration. What I don't see is anything different about Iran than any of these issues, right? And so that's why I want to push back, especially on the Iran question. But I share the belief that proliferation is bad and that people should undertake non-proliferation steps, right, including sanctions, including aggressive sanctions, and even including low-level covert action from time to time, right? I don't think it would have been a terrible idea to undertake a campaign like this against North Korea, right, at some point, and maybe they did. So I'm not particularly bothered by anything that's been happening so far, right? And so I think we are in agreement on those bases.
Right, and I think...
Here's a question. What? While we're on non-proliferation, I mean, you sort of skipped over it, and we haven't really talked about it much. I mean, there's other things we haven't talked about, like the Cuban Missile Crisis,
right,
and so forth. But what about Turkey and Saudi Arabia? Because a lot of people bring up what you sort of brought up in passing, the idea that Turkey and Saudi Arabia might go nuclear because of an Iran involved. I mean, how seriously do you take that possibility?
I mean, it's hard. I don't know. I mean, the Saudis seem more likely than the Turks, right? I mean, the Turks at least have a NATO nuclear umbrella. I mean, I understand why they want to have one, and lots of countries in NATO that are in the nuclear umbrella, you know, obviously have nuclear weapons. But I don't know. It seems more like the Saudis might view this as a necessary counterweight to an Iranian bomb. But I don't know the politics well enough of the countries to answer that question. But what I fear a little bit is that the closer that Iran gets to a bomb, that these countries decide that they can't afford to not have one. I mean, again, this gets back to the point. You and I would agree that the Saudis probably don't need a bomb. You know, as long as they have a good ally in the U.S., they really don't need a bomb. But at the same time, they may feel that, you know, they, for reasons that don't make a lot of sense, they have no choice but to develop one. So lots of countries do that, obviously. I mean, I don't think Iran needs a bomb. I mean, I think you agree. Iran does not need a nuclear weapon. It's a huge waste of resources on their part. And it's a huge waste of money, and it does them no good whatsoever.
Right.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, no. I mean, I think I generally share, especially with regards to Turkey. I wouldn't say that I don't want to take seriously the idea that Turkey might develop nuclear weapons, but Turkey's had this choice in the past, right? They've had the choice of internal balancing, and they could have launched a nuclear weapons program in the 50s. I mean, it's not a wealthy country then, but it was certainly wealthy enough to be able to at least think about a nuclear weapons program, and instead they resorted to external balancing, right, in the United States. And they still have that, right? They still have NATO in the United States. The Saudis are more interesting, but I think the I read around about the prospects of a Saudi nuclear weapon and a Saudi nuclear program. And, I mean, there's a little bit of stuff out there, and it is a secretive kingdom, so you wouldn't hear that much about it in the first place. But if the Saudis were really worried about the Iranian nuclear program, and were really planning to embark in their own program in response to it, it seems to me they would have done a lot more at that point than they actually appear to have done so far.
I think that's right. I think that's right. But don't you think those countries, though, the Gulf states or Saudis, would be more likely to try to buy a bomb from somebody than they would to develop their own technology?
To
buy nuclear, you know, cigarettes in Pakistan or something. They'd be more likely to do that than try to develop their own weapon.
I mean, I think it's just going to be external balancing. I mean, effectively buying U.S. support is, I think, what they're most interested in.
I agree.
Rather than going through all the troubles of either building or buying a weapon. Because even buying a weapon, you got a lot of problems, right? You have to deliver it, and you have to have a survivable deterrent and all this stuff. So.
That's actually a dumb argument on my part. I don't even know why I said that. They're not going to buy a bomb. You're right. I mean, actually, I take back that. They're much better off, and they're already doing this, actually, strengthening the military relationship with the U.S. than they are in trying to develop a nuclear weapon. And that's my guess is how this will go, is that you'll see – I mean, you already saw, what, $140 billion arms deal, I think it was, with the Gulf states and the U.S. I mean, this is how you're – I think – and that's not a good thing, by the way. I mean, further militarization in the region, that doesn't seem like a positive development, but that's another byproduct of Iran trying to have a bomb. I mean, this is, again, why, as I said, you know, you can't sort of unpeel the onion on this completely to know what the final result of this is, of Iran trying to develop, because all these countries are responding to it because they see it as a threat to them.
I mean, I guess, and we're running out of time, so we're not going to be able to talk about coin, which is sad, but... although the coin conversation is completely done anyway, but
exactly.
If Iran didn't have any sanctions on it, if Iran had never started its nuclear program, but it maintained an otherwise hostile aspect towards other Gulf countries and towards Israel and so forth, and instead of investing all this money in on its nuclear program, it had invested it in a modern air force. Because while the Iranians have groovy Maverick style F-14s, they don't really have anything else, and they can't really fly their F-14s,
exactly.
So they're their air force is archaic by regional standards, is certainly inferior to the Saudi air force by any metric you would care to approach the question. If instead of concentrating on nuclear weapons, they had decided to rebuild their air force, and they didn't even have sanctions on them, so they could buy groovy Russian MiG-29s that actually flew, and the latest Chinese aircraft, and maybe they even brought some Mirages and Rafales, from the French. Wouldn't the GCC and the Saudis be engaging in the same kind of arms buildup?
I suppose that's probably true. Yeah. I mean, Well, here's one difference. Let me ask this. Do you think that the relationship between the U.S. and these states would be as tightly interwound if Iran didn't have a bomb? I mean, I don't know. It's a good question, actually. You raise a good point. I don't know the answer to it. I mean, if – did when – after the Iranian Revolution, did the – well, the Iran-Iraq war happens. So it's kind of a moot point. But I'd say, did the Gulf states sort of build up because of that? But I guess they had Iraq to bleed.
Well, but they gave a considerable amount of assistance to Iraq, right? And Iraq enjoyed a lot of assistance from all of these countries during the war because of concerns about Iran, right? But concerns about Iran's conventional power at the time. Anyway, I mean, we're up to an hour now. Is there anything else you would like to say?
Well, I think... it's funny, you know, it's a fun conversation to have, to talk about this stuff. But I think in general, you know, the big sort of, it's funny because we talked about this in the context of Israeli interest and the Gulf state interest, and we've talked about less about what the U.S., interest is as far as Iran, and so how far the U.S. should go stop Iran from getting a bomb. And I think that's the sort of the big point that comes across to me is that, you know, I think for the region it's a big issue. And, of course, we have interest in the region. Obviously, you can't just dismiss those. But I do think that part of the debate in this country seems distorted about, you know, how dangerous Iran getting a bomb really is to U.S. security.
Right.
I mean, there's plenty of ways for the U.S. to deal with an Iranian bomb. that are not terribly expensive,
right.
and that don't and that don't involve us using military force, that will ensure Americans continue to be safe and have access to lots of cheap oil.
Right.
You know, and I think that's the more important, the most important takeaway, because we're getting some entering silly season on Iran right now in the campaigns, and all the Republicans want to talk about bombing Iran. But in, you know, I think if you look at it from a very narrow perspective of U.S. national security interests, there is no good reason for the U.S. to be engaging in the military strike against Iran without them having a bomb. It just isn't the level of benefit that we get from doing that is in no way commensurate to the cost that we would pay.
Right. Well, especially given that even with sort of wide-scale U.S. support for a sort of very broad air campaign, it's still very difficult to be able to say with any degree of certainty that you could eliminate the Iranian nuclear program, right? Delay, right, but not eliminate, even with the United States, unless you march to Tehran and assemble a new government.
I mean,
create a new government, so.
Even Max Boot, even my good friend Max Boot, says that a strike against Iran will only delay their program. I mean,
right.
That's an important point, by the way. We can delay it. I don't think we can stop it.
I concur.
Even if we could delay it, I'm not sure that it's. I don't think it's worth it. I mean, I'm sorry. Even if we could stop it, I don't think it's worth it.
Right.
Well, maybe. I don't know. that actually gets a little tougher. If you could, maybe you can make a case for it. If you can, it's hard to make the case, but I wouldn't. I'm sure I'd buy it, but. But you can make the case. Although I get in trouble
It's a different question, and we would probably have to play Persian incursion a bunch of times
to see
how that would work out. Which actually I have to buy, and I'm going to start playing for other reasons. But yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. I think we settled this.
The issue is now settled. I don't remember what it was or how we settled it, but the issue is now settled. So thank you for watching, and this has been a lot of fun.
All right. Great conversation. Enjoyed it.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.